Hi, everybody. My name is John Leslie, and you are listening to a program called Talking About Radio. And we've had just the greatest guests from all over the United States, in fact, all over the world on our program. And as we lead into saying hello to our guest, I've got a friend. I live in Winter Haven, Florida, in a community called Lake Ashton. And I've got a friend here whose last name is Ellwanger. And he is named after a city in Germany, the city of Ellwanger. And I often wondered how many people get cities named after them. Well, I'm going to say hello to my guest today, who I actually worked with about 25 or 30 years ago. And I wonder if he's named after a famous city. His name is Dave Hamburg. Hi, Dave.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Sweet.
Are you named after Hamburg, Germany?
You know, I really don't know. I know that my father is actually from a little town in Germany called Emmerichingen. And he came to America in late 1934, early 35, escaping Nazi Germany. And he actually sailed from Hamburg, but his name is and was Hamburg. It wasn't changed or bastardized or anything like that. It's actually Hamburg with the umlaut when he came here, eliminated the umlaut. And but whether he was named after the city, I don't know. I do know that his father in World War I was actually POW, Russian POW. And when he came home to Merchingen after the war, he had the name. I don't know how far back it goes. I'm guessing it goes back centuries. But yeah, that's how I got it.
Well, you know, that could be a whole. We're here to talk about radio, but then we also have lives and names and families, and it would be an interesting program to a different program. Talking about how things changed at Ellis Island, the names of people. My grandmother's name in the old country in Slovakia was Rusnak, and she lived in the Spišiakia section of Slovakia. And when she came to Ellis Island, they named her Spišiak. They just completely abandoned Rusnak and said, "Oh, Spišiak, okay, you're Spišiak." And so
That's funny, and I know that we're going in a different direction here just for a minute, but my mother's father came from Russia, and when he came through Ellis Island, he only spoke one word of English, and that was to answer the question, "How are you?" And he was able to say the word F-I-N-E, and that's the name that they gave him at Ellis Island.
Really? Fine.
Fine, yeah.
Larry Fine from the Three Stooges?
No relation.
No.
you know, I used to joke about that with Mom, and that wasn't even close. But that was kind of cute.
All right. Well, are you originally from upstate New York? Is that where your family is from?
No, I'm from Brooklyn. Came here in 65. I was born and spent the first 5 years of my life in Brooklyn. Dad worked for a company that transferred to Binghamton, and I moved up here, fortunately, and started school, went to school here. I was a Vestalite, first in Endwell. And, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about the fact that I took a career in radio. When we first moved up here and I started school in Endwell, my parents were called into a conference by the principal and the kindergarten teacher, and they said, "David has a very serious speech impediment. He's going to need speech therapy." And my mother said, "It's not a speech impediment. It's a Brooklyn accent, and he'll lose it."
Hmm. They really couldn't identify it.
Either they couldn't identify it, or you know, they had no clue. We may have been the first family from Brooklyn to start attending school in Endwell. I don't know, but they had no clue, and they wanted to send me to speech therapy.
And obviously they did not. And I'm not hearing a Brooklyn accent there. Somehow you were able to shed that, I guess.
Well, as Mom said, he's 5 years old. I'm 5 years old, and I'm gonna lose it. She never did. One of my sisters never did. And a dad lost his German accent, pretty much. Not all of it, but most of it. And there were some words that he spoke that you could tell had an accent to it. But by and large, my accent disappeared pretty quickly.
So this kid from Brooklyn, Dave Hamburg, what was your path to radio?
I never thought of radio. I know that so many radio people, dream about going into radio. I fell into it, John. It was whether it was a snake or not, I don't know. But what happened was in school, I was kind of a wise guy in some classes. I was also kind of quiet in many classes. But I was a wise guy. I was bowling with some friends one night. There was a moonlight bowling program at Midway Lanes, and you can go and bowl at night. They turn off the lights. They put red and blue pins in the racks, and you can win free games. And I was with my friends, and I said, boy, the guy that's doing this is terrible. And we laughed, and we made fun of him. I was 15 years old, and my friends dared me to go tell the owner of Midway Lanes that I can do this and I want that job. And they dared me, and they dared me, and they dared me. And I finally said, all right. So I went up to the counter at Midway Lanes, and I told this guy that I want to be a moonlight bowling announcer. I'm 15 years old. I'm a sophomore in high school. And lo and behold, he took my name and my number down. And the next week he called me and invited me to come down and do one night of moonlight bowling. And I did. And I was kind of a Don Rickles act. I would I would tease people and that kind of thing. And people kept coming up to me and saying, you should be in radio. You should be on the radio. And I never really gave it any thought until it was time for a summer job. Mm-hmm. And I saw a radio announcer. He was at WNBF. I don't know. It had to be after you. And then then again before you. I'm not going to give his name because I'm not real fond of the gentleman. And he has passed. Uh-huh. He told me to go to WKOP because they put dead people in front of their microphones.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah. So I let it drop for a little while. And then I figured I had worked at the factory that my father was a mechanical engineer. And I wasn't real crazy about the idea. So I went to WKOP. I had no idea what I had to do to get a job in radio. And I was totally, totally clueless. And I was told to make a tape. Well, how do you make a tape? So I was told, go home and read the newspaper onto a cassette tape recorder. And lo and behold, I did. I brought it back. And it was Ray Ross, who was the program director at KOP. And he didn't hire me, but I don't remember how I became friends with Rocky Brown and Jeff Simic, but Jeff and I have been friends for, God, since 1978, 79. I was at a high school, and I started at Broome Community College, now SUNY Broome Community College, and I was at the college, and I was sick one day. And to make a long story short, Rocky Brown was sitting with Roger Neal with Ray Ross, and he was, I guess, lamenting that he needed somebody to do Sunday morning church tapes. So Rocky picked up the phone and dialed my phone number, put the phone in Ray's hand, and That's how I got my start.
So many. In fact, you mentioned Jeff Simic, who has been a guest on this program.
Yes, it
is just amazing how these stories parallel each other. You know, nobody is hired immediately to do the morning drive show. You know, nobody has ever said, "Hey," other than later on when you establish yourself. But at the entry level, it's always, "Hey, you're going to run the church programs, or you're going to ride the board for the network, or something like that." And then those of us who are able to keep our heads above water during that time are perhaps fortunate enough to go on and make a pretty good living. But after the church tapes, yours, if I remember correctly, has always been a sports bent.
Yes, and one quick story, how fortunate I was to be at KOP, because on the Sunday morning church tapes, I used to twist the tapes. I was incompetent, John, and I know it. I admit it, and Ray showed a lot of patience with me. He moved me, in fact. Because it was a revenue stream, as you know, they moved me to public affairs on Sunday night and hired somebody else to do the church tapes, who was a little more competent. And then that guy left, and so I was doing both Sunday morning and Sunday night. But it was not an easy start. It was kind of rough. But yes, I do have a sports background, a very big interest. I always had a big interest in sports. And the reason that once I got into radio, I thought that it would be easy to get autographs. And, that's pretty much why I did what I did. I had an opportunity to meet the Mets in 1972, 1973, 1974, and 75, going down into the, being brought into the dugout and having fun with the ball players, and they were so good to me. I thought, well, if I could do this when I'm 12 and 13 years old, how cool would it be to get into radio where it's like shooting fish in a barrel to be able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did and progressed from there.
Well, this is a good opportunity for me to mention to you that, and perhaps you know one of these two guys. Couple of golfing buddies of mine, John Matlack, who was the 1968 Mets Rookie of the Year.
He was the rookie in 72, and I actually saw him pitch a game in 72, one of the first games of his career against the Houston Astros. And it was Johnny Bench who was the Rookie of the Year in 68. In 67, it was Tom Seaver.
Okay.
But yeah, go ahead. John Matlack was... Matlack was one of my favorite people at the time. I actually never met him. I would love to talk to him. I'd love to be able to get him on tape to put in my book. And we'll, I guess if you want to, we can talk about that later.
Okay. The other ball player that lives very near here, and we played golf every Sunday morning until recently, was a fellow by the name of Roger Nelson. And he pitched for the Kansas City Royals. Roger, I guess, had a great future ahead of him, but his arm kept giving him trouble, which is always not a good thing for a pitcher. And so he was just before George Brett and Al Hrabowski and all of those guys. So it would have been in the early 70s, I guess. But Roger's a good guy. He lives also just down the street from us here. But anyhow,
well, you tell that you now that you have my phone number, John. Tell him I want to talk to him and record an interview. I just did an interview with one of Matlack's teammates, actually two. Well, yeah, one of them, Jerry Kuzman. I did about an hour with Kuzman last week, and a couple of weeks before that, I talked to 1969 World Series. They were both World Series World Series heroes. I talked to 1969 Game 4. Hero Rod Gasper, who actually also appeared on the dating game right after the 69 World Series. But Gasper in the 10th inning scored the winning run of the Game 4 World Series, making Tom Seaver a winner of that series, of that game. And that was the only game in Tom Seaver's career that he actually, World Series game that he actually won.
Now, when you, if I remember correctly, you went from Binghamton on the air at WKOP, and how did you find your way to Pittsburgh? NBA. I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, I found my way to Pittsburgh. Actually, I was doing freelance reporting for Alphabet Soup up here. I was doing ABC and AP Radio and CBS and NBC, the Mutual Broadcasting System, RKO. I was doing BC Open. I was doing I was doing the Fame induction ceremonies and the induction game. And I was doing basketball in Syracuse, covering that for all of these radio. And I kept telling these people that I would like to get out of here. Can you help me? And I was talking to the Sheridan Broadcasting Network. I was doing work for the Sheridan Broadcasting Network, which was a long time ago, the Mutual Black Network. And they were sharing the Mutual facilities in Washington. And they were moving to Cocoa, Florida. The sports director at Sheridan said, "We like what you do. We may have something for you. We'll give you a call." After the regionals in 1983 in Syracuse, my parents were up here visiting from Georgia. Dad had transferred with the company that he was with here in Binghamton, transferred down to a little town called Noonan, Georgia, about a half hour southwest of Atlanta. And they were up here visiting. And the week after the regionals in Syracuse in 83, I get a phone call from the sports director at Sheridan. They're now in Cocoa. And he said, "We've been talking about you. We like what you do. We'd like to offer you a job." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yeah." And he told me what the job was going to entail. And I said, "How much does it pay?" And he said, "Well, you know, we have to pay you at least minimum." And I laughed. And I said, "I'm getting a quarter above minimum right now." And he said, "No, Dave, you don't understand. This is a union shop. We're part of the American Federation of Television Radio Artists, which is kind of a wing of the Screen Actors Guild. And we're going to have to pay you at least scale." So I said, "What is that?" And he said, "Well, it starts at $17.69 an hour." I said, "Don't hang up the phone. I'll be right there." They sent me a plane ticket. They sent me a plane ticket, and I went down there. We hit it off really well. And I started. So on April 14th, I was making a quarter above minimum wage back at WKOP. I'd actually also worked at INR, and there are some funny stories there, but we can address that at some point. I was making a quarter above minimum wage back at KOP. And on April 14th, that's what I was doing. On April 15th, I was making $17.69 an hour.
Quite a jump.
Yeah, it's, indeed.
You know, and a call from a potential employer saying, "We want to hire you," is much better than the employer saying, "I have bad news. We're going to have to let you go," which.
Now, yeah, I've been on the receiving end of that message, but never on the phone.
We're talking with Dave Hamburg. And I guess you're located in Binghamton, New York. Is that correct?
I am. Yes, I am. Now I came back to Binghamton in 91. I had started a radio syndication in Pittsburgh while I was at Sheridan, and Sheridan was starting to lose its mojo, I guess you could say. And people were in negotiations. They were reducing staff, and I had come up with an idea for them for a baseball program that Major League Baseball liked, because I had met with Bart Giamatti, who was the president of the National League, also the president of Yale, and it was a funny story having met him. But after I interviewed him on the veranda at the Onondaga Hotel in Cooperstown on a beautiful sunny day, he said, you know, Major League Baseball is trying to attract a larger minority audience. And we would love to be able to work with you. And he was friends with the chairman and the chairman and president of Sheridan, who was the first black dean of a major university. Ronald Davenport is his name, and he was the dean at Duquesne Law School, and the first black gentleman. He was a constitutional attorney, and he used to go to congressional hearings. But he and President of Yale, Bart Giamatti, were friends. So Giamatti said, "Listen, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go back. I want you to talk to Ron and see what we can do." And I went back and I talked to my news director and I talked to Davenport, and I said, "I have an idea for a show that we can do." And it was called I called it the Major League Baseball Network, Major League Baseball Notebook, and it was sanctioned by MLB, and we did that. And I started they started to take my responsibilities of the show away from me, and I wasn't very happy. So I said, "Well, if I could do that and have them make money, I can make my own show." And I developed something that I called Diamond Flashback. And Diamond Flashback was nostalgic. They were doing current baseball, and I was doing nostalgic baseball. I had one of the Pittsburgh Pirates as the voice of the program. We were on air for only 1 year. And the reason why I came back to Binghamton was because I needed to learn how to sell. I had one national company that was very interested in the program, but he wanted to know CPM, and I didn't know CPM from ABC. And he said, so I came back to learn how to sell advertising. And the concept of the short form, actually, as you know, it kind of went by the wayside.
Yeah, it started to fade out.
Exactly. So I had 200 baseball interviews and more than that that I did for Diamond Flashback. I came back to learn how to sell. I was not very good. And that's how you and I met when I started selling at KGB across the street. That didn't go, that was going fairly well. They dumped their sales staff, and I called my friend Roger, and Roger hooked me up with Cal, and Cal hired me, and I was an on-air guy that tried to sell and wasn't real fond of the idea, but of selling, and I didn't do very well, and I just stayed on the air. I was when they started the oldie station when the company started the oldie station. One of the salespeople, Dick Palmer, that I'm sure you know. He actually wanted me to be on the air on the oldie station because I was I had worked with the Binghamton Mets as their stadium master of ceremonies, sitting next to our good friend Roger Neal.
Roger Neal. In fact, I wanted to mention to our listeners that when you mentioned Roger, Roger is Roger Neal, who was a longtime hockey play-by-play guy for Stoner Broadcasting System at WNBF in Binghamton, New York. And Cal Barmada, who has been a guest on this program, was the sales manager of WNBF. And a guy, of all things, from Syria, a guy with a heavy Syrian accent, and was a dynamic radio sales person and just loved radio and loved America. And it's... He's one of the finest Americans that you would ever want to meet. Big supporter of our country, big supporter of radio broadcasting, and a big supporter of the air talent that he had an opportunity to go out and capitalize on and make a huge income for the station based on the personalities that were on the air. So
indeed.
Now I'm remembering. I worked at that time. I know I was on WNBF doing the morning show, and excuse me, and I know there was a period of time that were you filling in for Roger Neal, who was also our sports director, and later,
yes, I did.
Later became program director and just recently retired. But was that the deal? You were when Roger could not be there if he was on the road traveling with the hockey team or with the university basketball team, you would come in and do the sports.
Indeed, that's exactly what I did at NBF. I also did Sunday news for Bill Flynn.
Oh yeah, Bill Flynn was the polka guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How about that? You know, I go from from network radio and covering Super Bowls and Finals Four and baseball spring training, baseball All Star games. And I go to Sunday morning doing news and sports on a polka show.
You know, and that occurs to me. I really ought to have Bill Flynn on here at some point to talk to a guy who made, I guess, literally a fortune doing these polka programs, and it yes. was just everybody in town, whether you were Polish or not, everybody listened to Bill Flynn's Sunday morning polka show. It was a phenomenon.
It was a phenomenon, and it was, and he's back, by the way. But just amazing, where people saw me. People, I had done the Labor Day telethon here and public television auction, so I was somewhat visible, that people recognized me, and then they recognized me because I'm running through the stadium. Doing the quote-unquote master of ceremonies job at the Binghamton Mets. And it was amazing to me that I could walk through Wegmans and be stopped. And people would talk about something that Bill Flynn and I talked about the Sunday before. Yeah. Just amazing. Just amazing.
Now, if I picked up on it correctly, you mentioned earlier something about a book. Are you planning, or are you in fact in the process of publishing or writing a book about, I guess, sports?
Yeah, I am. It's actually it's a baseball book. Nobody really cares about Dave Hamburg or any of his radio exploits or anything else like that. Those baseball interviews that I did are actually pretty neat. They're oddball interviews. I'll give you, for instance, Mo Drabowski, who had pitched with the Baltimore Orioles in the 66 World Series. He had played in the 50s and 60s. He was from Ozana, Poland, by the way. And he claimed to be the best home run hitter in Major League Baseball to come out of Poland. And he was the only baseball player to come out of Poland. But he was a prolific prankster. And one of the things that he used to do, and one of the stories that he told me, was he would get rubdowns from the Orioles trainer, and sometimes the rubdowns would be hard, and he would tell them, "Don't do that, or I'm going to have to do something to you." They would be on the road, and he would go to a house phone in the hotel. He would say, "I'm Ralph Salvan, the trainer with the Orioles. I'm not in my room right now, but I need to leave a wake-up call for 1, 3, 5, and 7. I'm going to be cranky, and I'm going to tell you to cancel the phone calls, but don't do it. I have these I have an eye infection. I have these eye drops I have to take, and so you're going to need to call me at 1, 3, 5, and 7. And the next morning, he would see the guy and know that that he had a rough night because of the rubdown that he got on his arm the day before.
Hmm.
Stories of that nature. Of course, there are baseball stories. I talked to the other day. I talked to Jerry Kuzman, John Matlack's teammate. He was a wonderful interview, and he talked about the World Series. He talked about his career start. He talked about a practical joke that he played on Tom Seaver that was a classic. But all that to say, I mean, I've got 200 ball players that I've spoken to over the course of time, and I have these interviews, and I'm turning that in. I'm in the process of writing those stories, and I would love to be able to get a publisher. I'm not real fond of the idea of doing vanity publishing, but if I have to, I guess I will. It has become a bucket list thing for me now that I have actually retired. I was in public service for 20 years with the New York State Department of Labor and the Department of Transportation as their public information officer. And now I'm retired and looking to do that book.
We're talking about radio with Dave Hamburg. He's located in Binghamton, New York. And, you know, so many people have said to me and others in our industry, gee, you need to write a book. Well, they say to me, you know, you should be writing a book about your radio experiences. And those never go well. You know, even the big name guys that wrote books, their books never, Super Jock by Larry Lujack in Chicago, was never a bestseller. You know, I read it and I found it to be amusing, but I've often said I don't have enough relatives to make a book successful. And however, you're taking a different approach. You're baseball is the national sport here, and so there are a lot of people who would want to read these and find these the interviews of players gone by. It has, I think, all of the earmarks of being a successful book.
I hope so, you know, but it's a bucket list thing. And if it doesn't sell a single copy, I'm okay with that. You know, one of the stories, and you know, I know that you're not a huge baseball fan. One of the stories was from Luke Appling, who played with the Chicago White Sox in the 1930s. And I asked him if he knew Al Capone. Turns out he was friends with Al Capone, and he told me the story of Al Capone and Capone's cronies, and the fact that he had actually he had served at a speakeasy in Calumet, Illinois. He worked as a croupier, as a dice dealer. At one of his speakeasies, and he was just a great guy. He told all kinds of stories, you know. So I've got players going back to the 1920s. I talked to Lou Gehrig's roommate on the road. His name is Joe Sewell. He's in the Hall of Fame. It's an eclectic. It's baseball. But baseball is such a part of the fabric of American culture that the stories that I elicited from these people actually go beyond the actual play on the field.
I see.
There's a lot of that.
So it's kind of the background back stories that these people have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And well, let me give you a laugh. Roger and I used to go to the Hall of Fame and cover the induction ceremonies, and I want to say this was. It was either 95 or maybe 95 or 96. We went and we decided that we were going to do a Sunday night show of the Hall of Fame induction. And so we got all the sound and we brought it back to the radio station that night, that afternoon, late that day. And it was a 10 o'clock show that we had done. The next day we go into the Otisaga Hotel. They used to have an interview session with the Hall of Famers in the Otisaga Ballroom on Monday morning before the actual Hall of Fame exhibition game at Doubleday Field. So Roger and I walk in, we're carrying our tape recorders, and we're walking in, and Red Shaendienst, who had played with the St. Louis Cardinals, and he was the manager of the Cardinals in the Hall of Fame for his playing career and his managerial career. He's sitting in the lobby with a lot of other Hall of Famers. And Roger and I are walking out to the Otisaga porch, and we're walking, and Shaendienst stopped us, and he said, "Hey, you guys did a wonderful job yesterday." And we kind of looked at each other because why would a Hall of Famer be listening to WNBF if you could even get the signal in Cooperstown? turns out that the day before the actual induction ceremony, they had two actors who portrayed Abbott and Costello. And I was heavy at the time. Roger was, you know, thin, muscular, tall. And we thanked him. And we're sitting on the veranda at the hotel. And all of a sudden, Roger hits me on the leg. And he said, "Hey, Hambo, he thought that we were Abbott and Costello from the day before."
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's another Hall of Fame up around Cooperstown. Maybe, if I remember, it might even be in Cooperstown. The International Soccer Hall of Fame is up there someplace. And
yes, and in Oneonta, yeah.
Oneonta, yeah. Okay. One of the only reason I remember that was because after I finished my radio time and retired from regular radio duties, I went back to television and started doing television features, a series called Did You Know? And I decided to do a piece on the Soccer Hall of Fame in Oneonta. And so I don't know a whole lot about any of that stuff, and I don't even know why I would have picked that, but it was just another thing to do. And I remember what the curator said to me. We were talking about the most famous soccer player of all time, and as he said, it was Pelé. And mm-hmm. And he said, in fact, Pelé is probably the most famous athlete in the world. And I said, well, how could you say that? I said, well, what would make you think that's the case? He said, well, Pelé recently went to the Meadowlands to watch a soccer game, and 10,000 people paid money to come in to watch Pelé watch soccer.
Wow. Okay.
Well, you know,
that's funny.
Yeah.
All right.
So wow. when do you anticipate? I mean, are you sitting down and writing this book? Are you physically doing that, or are you just talking about it?
I'm transcribing my interviews and trying to figure out the best way to actually present it in a book. I have actually transcribed roughly of the interviews that I've done, probably about 200,000 words of actual newsmaker interviews, the actual answers to questions with slugs of questions. I would love to be able to do to have something out. I may be changing direction because of my new friendship with the New York Mets, particularly Rod Gasper, who hooked me up with Jerry Kuzman. And he's going to get me a couple of the other 69 Mets. What I'm thinking about doing is turning it into doing my first effort into a New York City baseball book, where I've spoken to Brooklyn Dodgers, I've spoken to New York Yankees, I have spoken to New York Mets and New York Giants. I'm thinking about just putting a compilation together of the New York baseball players, and I would like to have that out, even if I have to do Vanity Publishing to have that out by Christmas this year.
Now, what is Vanity Publishing? You've mentioned that.
No, it's another word for self publishing.
I see. Okay, but it's not a company.
No, it's whatever is the idea of self-publishing, whatever self-publishing companies will work with you. It's actually it's a term, and I learned that actually from another publisher in North Carolina who had interest, but he really only wanted my Negro League they only wanted my Negro League baseball interviews, and I didn't have enough of Negro League baseball players to do an entire book, and that kind of fell by the wayside. That died when they realized that of my 200,000 words, I only have about 10,000 words of Negro League baseball players.
Well, there are a lot of ways to sell a book. My wife and I took our motorcycle up to Fernandino Beach, Florida, and there was some kind of a festival going on up there. And that's a big crabbing, fishing industry, crabbing industry up there. And there was this old gent sitting in a folding chair in the middle of the sidewalk with a stack of books. And the book was called How to Catch a Crab. And and there were people lined up halfway around the block, including me. And I bought this book for like 10 bucks that he autographed. And I read it from cover to cover, and it was fantastic. There were all of these old maritime stories in there. It was really terrific. So, Dave Hamburg, you could get yourself a folding chair and go down to Manhattan once this is ready and sit on the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway and start selling it. The word would spread.
I'll take that under advisement, John.
Well, Dave, we're getting close to the end of our time. Is there anything else that we need to cover?
I had a whole career in Pittsburgh. I worked with Porky Chadwick. I'm sure you know who Porky was.
The daddy-o of the radio.
The platter-pushing papa. I worked with I don't know if he was a mutual friend, Perry Marshall, who was at KD. I don't know if you know Perry or not.
I do.
He goes way back, and he and I became friends. But a couple of funny stories. When I got to Pittsburgh in '85, they had the company. Was working with WPXI in Pittsburgh, and they were doing PXI was the Jerry Lewis telethon station, and for some reason they wanted me to host a segment of the event at the Monroeville Mall. I lived in Monroeville. That was my first apartment when I got to Pittsburgh, and they wanted me to work with them on the Jerry Lewis telethon. One of the things that they wanted me to do was introduce Tiny Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get there, and before we go on, and it was at center stage at the Monroeville Mall. They said, "Look, Tiny Tim is coming. We're going to want you to introduce him and then get off the stage." Okay, that's easy enough to do. So Tiny Tim is a late arrival, and I'm doing a segment, and they bring Tiny Tim out, and they want me now to interview Tiny Tim. What are you going to talk to Tiny Tim about? You're going to talk to Tiny Tim about the Labor Day telethon and his relationship with Jerry Lewis, and he did, and he was wonderful. Then I get from the floor director, I get the stretch sign. So they want me to continue. So now I'm trying to think of what else am I going to talk to Tiny Tim about? All right, we'll talk about Tiptoe Through the Tulips. And he had a pat answer. Of course, he had answered that 1,000 times. And he was very good. By the way, Tiny Tim, I don't know if you ever met Tiny Tim or not.
I spent a lot of time with him.
Did you really?
I did.
Okay, so you know that he had a baritone voice off air. His falsetto was the act. And then I get the stretch sign again, and he says, I said, "All right, let's talk about Johnny Carson." And we talked about Johnny Carson, and then talked about his wedding on Carson. And I said, "How is Miss Vicky?" He was there with a woman, and he said in his falsetto voice, he could have buried me if he wanted to. But he said, "As you know, Mr. Hamburg," and he called everybody Mr. or Miss. "As you know, I'm not married to Miss Vicky anymore. This is my new wife, Miss." I don't remember what her name was, but that was it. And they allowed me to skulk off of just to crawl off the stage, and I did. And he was wonderful after after he did his thing, and that was pretty neat.
Yeah. Well, one of the experiences I had I had a number of experiences with him, but he was appearing at a place called Dom Bruno's Beach House on Oneida Lake near Syracuse. And I was the master of ceremonies for the event, and I was actually his host for the weekend that he was there, and we dined with him. My daughter, Chris, was about 13 at the time, and he was a big star, you know. And whoever thunk up the idea that Tiny Tim could do a onstage concert had their head where it didn't belong, because he can only sing one song. You know, he got up and he did Tiptoe Through the Tulips with that ukulele. And then he did a whole cadre of other covers with that ukulele singing in falsetto. And after about the second song, everybody was just sitting there eating their dinner and not paying any attention to him.
But what a nice man he was.
Yes.
I spent years in press boxes, and I was at a Cleveland Indians game. And then you'll appreciate this. I'm at a Cleveland Indians game, and they are embarrassing stories that I laugh at now. I was at this game in Cleveland, and I'm sitting in the second row of the press box, and I'm by myself. And this man in the cowboy hat walks in with a Texas drawl, and he sees an empty seat next to me, and he says, "Is that seat empty?" in his Texas drawl. And I said, "Well, it's not if you sit there." And he sat down, and we started talking. And we're talking about, you know, he said to me, "Where are you from?" And I told him that I'm in from Pittsburgh. And he said, "We have one of your boys on our team." And they had a guy by the name of George Hendrick, who had played with the Cardinals, played with the Pirates, and he had gone to the California Angels. I said, "Yeah, George Hendrick. He's a pretty good ball player, but he's not very friendly. He refused to talk. He refused in Pittsburgh to talk to the media." And I said, "He's not very friendly. He doesn't talk to the media." And this guy said, "Well, he talks to me." And we're sitting there, and we're chatting. We're talking about the game that's in front of us, and we're talking about different things. And I said to him, "I'm from Pittsburgh, but I'm originally from a little town in upstate New York called Binghamton. It's about halfway between Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Syracuse, New York." And he said, "Oh, yeah, he knows all about it. He's been to all three of those cities." About the seventh inning, he gets up and he leaves. And the PR guy for the Angels turns around and says, "You don't know who you were talking to, do you?" And I said, "No." He said, "That was the cowboy. I'm spending an hour talking to Gene Autry, not realizing that I'm talking to Gene Autry." And for whatever reason, I didn't introduce myself, and he didn't introduce himself. And he's sitting there, and we're having a nice, friendly conversation about, you know, everything under the sun. And how do you not recognize Gene Autry? I have no answer to that question.
I sort of do. I met Gene Autry in 1978, and his physical appearance was not the same as when Santa Claus is coming to town, or here comes Santa Claus. Yeah, his appearance changed dramatically over the years, much like mine did.
And mine. Yeah. I lost a ton of weight since you saw me, so. But
he got a little portly toward the end there, so I could see why that might be the case.
It was just amazing.
Dave, we really are at the end of our time here. We can maybe schedule another session in the future and talk about some more things. I really wanted to find out if you ever had any experiences with a guy who you could write a whole book about him alone, and that's Bob Prince, the play-by-play announcer for the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yes.
For many years. There are so many stories.
Yeah, and just quickly, I met him a couple of days before he passed away. He came into the press box. I got to Pittsburgh in June, and on June 3rd, that was my first game at the Pirates, and he came in, and I was introduced to him, and it was just a thrill to meet the Gunner. And there are just so many stories.
Oh, there's a piece of tape floating around. I used to have it It's about 45 minutes long, and it's him feeding commercials from Forbes Field back to KDKA on closed circuit. And
I heard that.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I've lost the tape. I've asked a ton of people if they have a copy of it. A couple of people have said yes, but they're not going to give me another copy of it. And I'm just sorry that I don't have it. Well, Dave Hamburg, it's been a pleasure having you on Talking About Radio. My name is John Leslie.
John Leslie.
Yeah.
The next time we do this, we'll actually stay with radio.
Oh yeah. Okay.
We've got a lot to talk about on radio too.
Yeah, but, you know, this is kind of like your baseball interviews. You know, we all have our lives. Radio people have great stories about their lives and what they've done, and people like to, because they hear us on the air. They don't really know the background or how we really are in our personal lives. And I think people like to listen to that and hear it and find out, not only radio people who are listening, find out that others are like them and have families and have these great stories to tell. And we all have a lot of laughs every time we do one of these programs. The people we interview really have such great stories and love to tell them. And it drifts away from radio from time to time, and that's just fine.
But yeah, Dave, and we didn't. You and I didn't even get to talk about our experiences together.
Well, that's true enough. Yeah. Well, golfing, for example.
What's that?
I say golfing, for example.
That is certainly one of them, indeed.
We'll save that for another program. Dave Hamburg
sounds like a winner.
Thank you very much for being with us on Talking About Radio.
John, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.